Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Loose Units Origins. It's a brand new season of Loose Units, and this season we're going through the book, chapter by chapter. Dad, you've got your copy of Loose Units in your hot little hands right now, don't you?
Well, technically no, because it's right, it's to my left.
Okay.
It's about 4 inches from my elbow.
Okay, it's really important to know where your book is at all times. It's like an emergency exit, okay? So
yep.
If you're listening to Loose Units Origins and you don't know where your copy is, make sure you can see it in case something goes terribly wrong and you need to, you know, make a hasty exit into the book.
Yeah, I think it's important to actually, I'm not saying it's essential, but I mean, let's face it, Paul, the book is actually technically, I hate to say this, but it's about me, and I still read the prologue and chapters 1 and 2 this morning. Mm-hmm. I got up extra early. I didn't read it then, but I got up extra early. But anyway, I did ultimately read it, and I found it. It's great going back, and I think I think it'd be nice if you could actually read it then listen to what we talk about.
Yes, but I mean, obviously, if you've got a copy, that's great. If you don't, you know, hit up a local library, try and find the audiobook. But if you can't, don't worry, because, you know, this won't kind of ruin things for you, because one of the core conceits of Loose Units is it's my taking something Dad did and telling a story based on that. So the reason we're doing Origins is because the way it actually happened is, you know, that's sometimes, you know, quite different. So we are going to get the cases behind the stories. Would you agree with that, Dad?
100%, Paul, and it's really great. It was a great idea. Actually, who came up with the idea?
Me.
Are you sure?
100%.
Did I have anything to do with the idea?
Nothing whatsoever.
Thank you. No, look, it's weird. You're not going to believe this, Paul, but when I was reading the prologue in chapters 1 and 2 today, it just brought up so much extra stuff. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, if at certain points during the episodes and during the breakdown of Loose Units and going into the stories behind the book, if at any point you remember something that you've never talked about before, then we are actually technically allowed to segue and do episodes about those cases. So, and also here's something I want to talk about, Dad. I got asked this in an interview recently, and someone said, because there is a fairly spectacular fight scene in this book. And someone asked me if that's how it actually happened. And I said, no, of course not. But I did point out the fact that it must be weird for you reading stories based on things you did in which there's a character called John who does stuff that sometimes is stuff that you didn't do but that completely works within the story. Are you worried at any point that you will start to kind of, after you read these stories so many times, that you will begin to kind of replace your memory? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
I understand. You're talking about implanted memory.
Yeah, you'll get. You might get.
Implanted versions of the actual events.
It's like in Blade Runner, but you're Rachel and you're having memories about a dream of a unicorn. Remember? Do you think that'll happen?
I don't think it's going to happen that much.
Okay.
But what I do think will happen is that it will bring up a lot of stuff that I won't say is repressed, but I have a very, very good memory of incidents. At least I think I do. It's going to be fascinating. I'm really excited.
I think one of the interesting things about Loose Units as a writing project was taking things you did and putting them within a kind of like a little you know, like a narrative that flashes back and forth between the past and the present, where you and I are sitting in a room talking through these cases. Now, this episode, we're doing the prologue, and we are doing Don't Be a Tool, which is the first actual chapter, really, which talks about your time working as a kind of apprentice toolmaker.
Which I hated every second of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then we're going to try and stray into purely academical this week if we can. But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is in the prologue, I talk about the fact that I saw crime scene photos from the case, which is the final chapter in this book. It's about a witch, and we're not going to go ahead and spoil that right now. But when I was a kid, I did see those photos, and I did kind of, you know, get a little bit scarred by them. But one of the things that I didn't put in the book, Lee's story, living hold court, and you would tell stories. I mean, you're a natural born storyteller. I think that's why I got so annoyed at you being so shy on stage at our live shows, because I thought, but you've been telling stories my whole life. You would have friends over to the house, and you would be sitting there pacing around telling these incredible stories. And one of the stories I kept overhearing as a kid was the case of the witch. And I didn't put that in the book because it wasn't kind of, you know, cinematic or striking enough. But in the prologue, I talk about rocking up to your house in Beacon Hill and sitting down with you to talk through the cases and kind of kicking off the project. Now, in reality, do you remember where the interviews for the book took place?
Shit.
Yeah.
Paul, this is proof that we haven't really... God, you've sort of hoodwinked me. Is that
maybe a little bit. I mean, I'm not trying to test you, but...
I mean, they took place in cafes and coffee shops and lots of places.
And a bar at one point.
And a bar, that's right.
And the back of a churros restaurant, yes, and I would just sit there with my phone out, but yeah.
It happened all over Sydney.
But if you... It did. It happened all over Sydney, and it was... I wish I could play you some of the audio, listeners, because just Dad sounded so different back then, because he hadn't hit that kind of confidence level that he gets from having, you know, listeners kind of tell him how great he is. And we recorded in various sort of, you know, eateries and whatnot on my phone. Mm. Yeah. So what did you make of... I mean, okay, I'm just going to read you a quick... So we're going straight in. We're diving straight in. I'm going to read you the description of the room in which, in the book, we talked through these stories together and had all these wonderful father and son moments, okay?
Mm.
Okay. Picture a study. Mahogany, leather, a faint fug of cigar smoke, and light perforated by Venetian blinds. Fill the room with bookshelves, and fill those shelves with an inordinate number of Clive Cussler novels. Now, put my father on a leather armchair in the center of the room, flanked by the same boxes I crash-landed on decades earlier, their lids still battered from the impact. The room has floorboards with antique rugs laid over one another clumsily, and there's a window open. Dad always leaves a window open. Is any of that true?
Clive Cussler?
Yep.
And window open?
Yep.
I think what's happened to you, Paul, is that you have created a fantasy room,
yeah,
almost sort of from the Dickensian times. And in fairness to you, what you've created is beautiful, and what you've created is what I too would love to have had as my private den.
Mm.
But we, as you know, had bought and sold 7 properties in total.
Yeah.
And you and the kids had lived in many, many houses, some of them historic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an antique dealer since the early 80s up until the present. And it was not uncommon for you children to come home and a few times a week, all the furniture would be replaced. You kids probably dined at maybe 200 dining tables. You would have seen over 100 clocks, almost an infinite number of artworks, because I used to love bringing things home and then I would sell them because that was my business.
Yeah.
And we had a house with beautiful floorboards, the way you've described them. So I think what you've done, you've created this beautiful ethereal dream using a combination of all the places you'd lived in, to create something that you thought was appropriate. And you, and funnily enough, Paul, you created something that is how I would love to sort of, you know. And we had leather chairs. We had all of that. Every single thing that you've described, we had. And Clive Cussler was and still is my favourite author.
But Dad, that is fucking eerie that you're saying this, because I was going to reveal this to you, that I actually just, because we moved around so much, and I wanted to try and, because I always wanted to have that one house that we lived in, the family house. So I took bits from all my favourite features of the lounge rooms and living rooms of all the houses we've had and put them into a single room. And then I remember that you used to smoke cigars for a brief period and had a lovely humidor. And yep. So I just sort of crammed it into one fictional room, which was a composite, like a megazord of all your various rooms, and then put you in it, and it just felt right.
That's lovely, Paul. But look, I had a humidor, but I had this weird, and I'm really sharing quite an intimate and personal thought with the people that really matter, and that's our incredible listeners. And listeners, I'm just going to share something very briefly with you, and that is that Paul's sister, Anne, she had, she had a few boyfriends, and every time I'd meet a new boyfriend, I would think, wow, this guy's really great, and I couldn't help myself, and what I used to do is I used to give all her boyfriends gifts,
yeah,
but not shitty little gifts.
No, like priceless.
I would like really, really, really good stuff. I would seek out the rarest whiskey in Australia. I would give them an incredible limited edition photograph from our lounge room wall. And Christine had bought me for Christmas a humidor that was beautiful. And I remember giving the humidor to one of her boyfriends, an amazing black and white photograph that I paid pretty good money for to another boyfriend who was a dud. Sorry, Anne. And Anne would come up to us afterwards and say, oh, Dad, you know, what did you think of that particular guy? Now, I have never, ever given an opinion on any of you kids' boyfriend or girlfriends ever, because let's face it, it's none of my business. And I'm just saying that, yes, I did love, I had a cigar cutter. I love the whole ritual of cigars, aside from the minor thing about throat cancer. But I guess I weaned myself off cigarettes and onto cigars, and I still really love cigars. But I gave this humidor to one of Anne's boyfriends. I mean, absolutely ridiculous. And I actually think I was mad, and I wish I still had the humidor. And Christine was really pissed off.
Well, it's in the book. You know, it's not described in the book, but it is... It's in the book, safe and sound. There is a version of that humidor in a world in which you never gave it away. So don't fret. Now, as for the description of you, Dad. Now, picture my dad, John. Tall, graying, stylish. He's a hair over 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, in his late 50s, calm and collected. And he maintains this air of cool right up until the moment I enter the room. It is now that I clock his new reading glasses, which magnify his eyes to such cartoonish levels that I have to sit down on account of the laughter. You went through a phase where you wore... first of all, listeners, we're going to get to the crime soon. We just want to get the prologue out of the way and just get through, you know, just some of the inaccuracies.
No, it's great. Yeah. It's important.
You think that's a fair description of
no,
you?
No, I don't. No, I was totally... I was actually mildly...
Offended?
Look, well, I was moderately offended when you described... I mean, I looked like a caricature of Mr. Magoo.
I literally called you handsome. Yes, I said tall, graying, stylish.
No, but the glasses. Oh, the didn't,
that's not. That,
you made it sound like my glasses were the bottom of Coke bottles. Now, I had extensive eye surgery.
Yeah.
So I actually had corrective surgery so I can have macro vision and read through my left eye.
Yeah.
And my right eye is for long distance. And it kind of worked. And I still don't wear glasses. And I don't have blue eyes.
But you have to tear books in half and hold one half really close and the other half in the other hand really far away.
Hmm. Yep.
You're ruining books.
The blue eye thing, that threw me as well. But, I mean, you're the author and...
Oh, fuck, that's right.
I was wondering...
You don't have blue
eyes.
You
actually just wanted me to have blue eyes.
No, I just... I've Mandela affected myself into thinking... We've covered this before. Not only have we covered this before, we've covered the fact that we often cover the same thing before. And now that we're doing a season covering something which people have read before, shit's going to get very Inception. So without further ado, let's jump into the really good stuff. Let's get into chapter one, Don't Be a Tool. Now, chapter one is primarily concerned with the fact that you ended up as an apprentice toolmaker, and it kind of ends with that really great, fairly cinematic moment. And this is something we talk about all the time on stage. Loose Units is a love story between you and Christine Verhoeven, who ended up being my mum and your wife. She wasn't called Christine Verhoeven when you first met. That doesn't matter. It's really getting confusing. The point is, the core conceit of this whole chapter, and indeed of the beginning of your love story with mum, is that you were at the, like, just at your wit's end, and a newspaper clipping appeared in which mum was on the newspaper advertising to like a recruitment ad for the New South Wales Police Force. Could you talk us through that, please?
Well, that part of the story, Paul, is very accurate.
Okay.
But what we have not mentioned is that I actually was working. I finished my apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. Again, I stress, I hated every day, every minute of that. But when I finished my apprenticeship, So I worked for the Safe Company, but I also worked for the envelope manufacturer. And I was sitting in this factory during a break, and there was a torn segment of a newspaper on the floor. Now, you very, very beautifully described this wind that kind of, in almost a fantasy world, blew and twirled, and you could see this piece of paper swirling around, and I may have grabbed it, but it was on the floor. I was having a break. I was totally at my wit's end mm-hmm. with my life in terms of I didn't know what I wanted to do. And it's an incredibly true and accurate portrayal, Paul, of me reaching down, and there was a torn fragment of a newspaper, probably the Daily Telegraph, and there was a photograph of two police officers standing. So if you can imagine the passenger door and the driver's door both open, and there was a rather sexy woman in uniform, albeit a very old-fashioned uniform, holding the sort of the police radio, and there's a caption, something like, "Join the New South Wales Police Force today." And it had the salary, and the salary from memory was around about $370 a week. And that blew my brains out. With 6 weeks paid annual leave, and I thought, golly, this is sounding really exciting. I was looking for a change. I loved adrenaline. I made my way from that toilet in that factory to a company telephone. I called the number, and I began the process of what was going to become a wonderful part of my life, my future.
Now, talk us through that actual process, because, I mean... Well, first of all, when you were working at the toolmakers,
it was called Cellpack. They made envelopes, an envelope manufacturing company. At the time, very, very high tech. Shall I talk about what happened on my very last day there, or should we leave that until? Well, look, I felt so confident. I had this weird feeling that I really had a chance, and I did something quite silly. Sort of on par with buying a house and then, but buying it before you've sold your house. So you really, really put your nuts in a vice. So what I did, I hated my job so much. Now, this is a little bit of I'm slightly ashamed to tell you and the listeners this, but there were these big machines that made envelopes, and they were about maybe 20 to 30 meters long. And they had two process workers working really, really flat out as the envelope spun into this little section. And I knew I was going to leave the company, and I left prematurely, but I was so confident that I'd get into the New South Wales Police Force. And what I did, I wound the machine up to the maximum speed, well beyond the manufacturer's specifications. And I remember walking out of the factory, and I looked back, and there were envelopes flying into the air. There was pandemonium. And I felt, I had this warm glow feeling about, well, you know, F you, I've had a shitty time, turned the machine up. And then I went downstairs, and I wrote this letter, and I put it on the passenger seat of the managing director's Mercedes convertible, basically telling him what I thought of this particular company. And I went home to my apartment where my brother and his flatmate were, and I began the process of joining the New South Wales Police Force. And
well, first of all, one of the things that always strikes me about this chapter, about Don't Be a Tool, is that your family didn't want you to become a police officer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, my aunt Frances, who was involved in all the protests during the moratorium in the late 60s, you know, the anti-Vietnam War protests. And she is a pacifist, not unlike yourself, Paul. And she used to go to these demonstrations, and she wore spectacles that she needed. Obviously, she had pretty shitty vision, and she was actually at university at the time. And she was arrested by the police during that tumultuous time, and they basically bashed her, my Aunt Frances, and her spectacles fell off her face, and one of the police officers just basically squashed and ground the lenses into the road. And, you know, that was pretty upsetting for her, obviously, and she had, that became a bit of a family story. So there was always this feeling. And also we had had relatives, fairly well-off relatives in Sydney, and one of the relatives had had some uncut rubies, and they were catching a cab in the city in George Street, and they left this packet of uncut rubies in the back of a cab, and they got in touch with the cab company, and they were never, ever returned. Someone had stolen them, and the police seemed fairly disinterested. So there were a number of events in our family's life that had kind of made them, not that they had a lot to do with the police, but it became a little bit of a sort of a feeling that it was perhaps beneath anyone in the family to do that.
Okay.
And then when I decided and let the family know that I had considered and wanted to join the New South Wales Police Force, there were members in my family that almost, can you imagine this? They almost couldn't look at me. They couldn't talk to me.
Really?
It was as if I wasn't already the black sheep of the family, which I was for lots of reasons. But that just seemed to a lot of people in my family, because a lot of them were academics, for better or worse, but they just felt that it was a bit of a weird thing to do, and some of them really felt strongly in terms of I shouldn't perhaps consider that, which made me all the more defiant and all the more determined to make something of my life.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
So, I didn't realize that there'd been multiple incidents which kind of made the Verhoeven clan, you know, chafe at the idea of the police. Do you remember what happened when you told, I'm just going to go straight to the source, like what did your mum think when you told her? Do you remember how it went?
Look, I think mum was at her wit's end with me, you know, and perhaps she was one of the few people in the family that thought, look, she's always pretty well been on my side. Mm. My father, I don't think he really cared that much, as long as I had a job. That type of negative reaction did not come from my immediate family.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Not my mother, not my father, and certainly not my grandmother. She, anything I ever did, she thought was great.
And this is K letters, isn't it?
Kathleen, yeah.
Yep, yep.
But some of the other people, and perhaps rightfully so, based on their experiences.
Yeah.
But I was going to become the first, well, golly, hang on a sec. We must be careful here because... maybe we should wait a little while and talk about that other relative.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. We can wait.
Save that for. Yeah, we'll save that.
Yeah, we can wait.
Because that was a bit of a shock, that story, because that I'd never been told about another relative.
I'm just going to grab this chapter again. I'm enjoying this kind of like blow by blow. Are you enjoying the kind of interviewer?
It's great. Thing? Yeah. I really like it.
Great. According to the book, and again, when I did the interview sessions with you for the book, it was all info that you gave me. So if it's wrong, then whatever. It says in the book that you were 19 years old at this point.
Yeah.
19, very skinny.
Very. 76 kilos I weighed. Well, that's the day I got to the academy and they weighed us all. I was so, mate, weedy.
Do you want to hear something weird that's going to... I weigh exactly 76 kilos right now.
Well, that's...
Weedy, apparently.
No, you look great.
You said weedy three times.
Okay, well, I was referring to Bill and Ben.
Really?
Flower pot men.
Sure.
That was just one of the terms they used, weedy. But, look, when I went to 14 College Street, opposite Hyde Park in Sydney, and I would have made my way in by bus, and... super nervous. I always had a respect, and I always thought the police were really important. I had had one encounter with a police officer. He was the boyfriend of a girl that I knew. She went to a private school, and he was everything that I thought at the time. Now, I was probably 18, and I used to go to this family's house occasionally, and there was... this police officer in Sydney, he was, I'll tell you how long ago it was, he had a holster that they had to actually unclip. So you couldn't actually see the gun at all. So by the time in those days you'd try and fumble around to get your gun out, you'd definitely be shot. That's why they got rid of that type of old-fashioned holster. But he was going out with a girl who was in high school. So that presents some weird stuff.
What? Where?
Yeah. You remember when I was living in DY with those Indonesian guys after I'd been booted out of home?
Nope, you never told me that.
Cool. Shall I elaborate?
Why not?
Well,
it's called Origins, Dad. We need to find out the origin of everything.
Well, when I was booted out of home and I had to find myself an apprenticeship, which I did, I didn't even know what an apprenticeship was because, as everyone knows, because I've gone on ad nauseum, is that I was, dare I say it, the first person in the history of all the generations not to go to university. And for the listeners, I actually got 6 A-levels in my school certificate, so I was a bloody good student, and I certainly had the potential to go on. And education was free at university, blah, 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 blah. You can still see I still crap on about it.
Thank you, Gough Whitlam.
Thank you. But I moved in with some Indonesian guys, and one was a practicing Muslim, and he used to pray 5 times a day. Mm-hmm. And he and his flatmate, they were so kind. They felt sorry for me and they took me in, basically. And what they did is that they shared a bed. They slept in a double bed and gave me the spare room. And they did that for years. And I thought that was jolly nice of them. I don't know whether I'd do that. For a weedy, sad, pimply teenage boy in Sydney. And there I stayed. And I got to make friends in that particular area. And I befriended these particular girls from a private school nearby. And one of them was hanging out with a police officer. And he used to come around. And he was from the country. And he was everything that I vowed, if I ever became a police officer, I would not do. On every level, he was.
You mean you wouldn't date high school girls for one?
I don't know about that, but he was just such a... I just don't know how he got in the police force. He was not super bright. And he used to leave his gun hanging around and... I thought, wow, if this is what the police force is all about. But then, you know, ironically, years later, I did end up joining that establishment. But he was not a great role model.
How old were you at this point? 16?
I would have been. No, I was driving, so I was 17.
17. Okay, so you're saying, so this is kind of interesting, and this is part of the reason I'm glad we're doing Origins. So in the book, and all my knowledge that I've turned into the other books, Electric Blue as well. You joined when you were 19, and as far as I was aware, you hadn't really had too many run-ins with the police. The fact that you had a negative impression of a police officer before that point is really interesting to me.
Yes, but I was wise enough to realize that I certainly didn't tar the entire police force, because also there's that great story when my car was broken into. Remember that one in the city?
Yeah, I remember that.
And with the Christmas presents, and I was peeing, taking a leak, and the two police officers threatened to take me back to Central Police Station, which was a horrific police station. And they basically were nice and said, look, you know, they let me go. And I thought, well, that's a feather in, that's a plus. And that was a good thing.
Yep.
So you kind of weigh these things up. So when I had to go into police headquarters, which was a very austere and ominous building, it was an entire skyscraper, but it was about 18 floors, and it held everything to do with the police force.
How'd you feel? Were you nervous?
No, I was shitting myself. And I caught the elevator, and just you had to sign in, and there were security officers, obviously, and I went up to the recruiting section. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I had to do was an IQ test.
Hang on. So you've just said that you encountered an officer who was somewhat dim. So are you saying that, like, what? Okay, what is the low bar?
Maybe they'd... What do you mean the low bar?
Like, what's the lowest you can be to get into the police force? Do we know?
IQ-wise?
Yeah.
Well, your mother worked in recruiting.
So
she would really know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. But let's say the average IQ is 100. I would say maybe for the police force was perhaps maybe 110 as a minimum.
Okay.
And so I remember sitting down with a whole... So it was like a recruiting day. Mm-hmm. In fact, they were recruiting and they were having these sort of sessions. They were probably having two a day for maybe a week or two. And we all just piled into this classroom, and it was just full-on old-style IQ tests, which is mathematics, comprehension, English. You know, you had to you had to read a paragraph and correct it. So they were obviously wanting to get some sort of people that had a basic sense of grammar, which I did, most definitely. And then they must have... processed. That's right. They took all the results out, all the forms, and they marked them very, very quickly, because within 30 minutes, that's when I went in to have my physical. So I had a medical where they took blood pressure and all that sort of stuff. You know, I don't think they did body fat, and they certainly didn't need to do it. They just looked at me and thought, well, you're scrawny. But in I was going to say the olden days, for God's sake, but in the very early 80s, like late 70s, early 80s, one of the things, if you were a male, in the ad, it actually said you had to have a chest expansion of, now I don't remember what it was, but it was in inches, and let's say it was maybe 38 or 40 inches. And one of the things, now you said in the book that the doctor did that particular thing with the tape measure.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor did everything bar that.
Yes.
And there was a sergeant, I remember, and he's standing in this room. He had a tape measure, you know, those floppy canvassy type things. And he basically came up to me and he put his arms around me to reach so he could put the tape measure behind me. And they lift it up your back and they have it going underneath your armpits.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, breathe in. So I breathed in as much as I could. I put as much air in my lungs as possible. And I fell short, as you did say in the book. And I gave it everything, and I desperately wanted to get into the police force. I just wanted it. Being in that building and seeing police in uniform and the cars out the front, I thought, wow, this is, you know. And then I had all sorts of visions of what I, you know, tearing around at 120 20 miles an hour in the city and crazy stuff because I loved, I loved driving. And it was sort of the machismo, the vibe. It was everything. And I thought, and he basically looked at me and he said, "Mate, I'm going to sort of paraphrase what he said to me, but he basically said to me, you've got one more chance. And I'll tell you what. Now, I remember he, because he's the guy, this is like make or break. I'd got through every single test and this is the final thing. It's insane. They, now you look at police. I mean, it's a cross section of the real society we're in. But back then they had a minimum height. They had really set standards that had been in probably used for 100 years. And when I took that final, inhale, and I thought this is it, and I'll never forget. Because I could feel the tape going a bit slack, and what he did, he moved the tape about an inch up to the, as if there would have been someone looking at him, and then he said, "Yeah, you're in," and he wrote down my chest expansion and he fudged the figures, and I don't know who that guy was, but I'm grateful to him. And
the doctor has stamped your form, let you in. That's all in keeping. It is interesting that one of the first things that has happened to let you into the police force, a bastion of, lawmaking and rule keeping, and, they would break the rules to let you in. Did you consider that kind of a red flag, or were you just grateful?
No, I was really grateful. I was so excited. I knew I'd passed the IQ test. I knew physically I was in really good nick. Mm. Although back then I did smoke, and I kind of backed off the cigarettes. I began to back off.
All right. So once you're in the academy, you're sitting there. You get to the academy. You're being taught. Do you remember what it felt like to actually rock up to the Redfern Police Academy the first time?
Yeah. Well, it was winter, mm-hmm. and I think I joined in June or July. So imagine Sydney in midwinter, where it is really cold, single digit number like degrees.
Yeah.
And I would have made my way in on a bus. Mm-hmm. And we came in the front gate and we went off to the right into these big, big classrooms. And they got us pretty well everyone to strip down to their underwear. And I had a white singlet. And I was sitting next to this guy that made Arnold Schwarzenegger look pretty anorexic. This guy was built like a brick shit house. He was roided up. He had muscles on muscles, and he was sitting next to me on this. We were all sitting on top of tables, and they came in, and their objective was to sort us into six classes, and they just simply did it alphabetically. And so it was A, B, C, D, E, F, and F. We got the nickname F Troop
because of Verhoeven. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We were sort of a motley crew. We had a couple of girls in the class. It was a really interesting cross section. But one of the guys in the class was actually a helicopter pilot that was going to do the initial training and then go to the air wing. He'd been a pilot in Vietnam. So we had guys that had come from farms. We had air hostesses with various Australian airlines. We had school teachers, actually quite a few school teachers. We had a girl that I'd gone to school with, who'd gone on and done her HSC and become, finished her teaching degree. So it was really, really, it was a mixed bag of fruit. And then we were all sort of led up to our classrooms. I could take you there to this very day, to the classroom, and I can... mentally I'm sort of going there and I can describe it in great detail. And we were introduced to our two instructors, who were, as fate would have it, two of the nicest, most knowledgeable, interesting police officers. They were both sergeants, and there was Dennis Shipley and Mr. Morrison, and they were the nicest, most... Oh, look, it was like a family. And we just settled in. And I was so, so happy and grateful to be on this on this sort of the cusp of a future. And I, and at that time, I thought I would stay in the New South Wales Police Force until I retired. There was no reason to ever contemplate. And it was just, it was exciting. Every day was thrilling. I just couldn't wait to get to class. It was so, Paul, in your book, Loose Units, that I read this morning,
yes,
as per my homework duties,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that's always intrigued me is that you had me and my fellow class members in class,
mm-hmm.
and then outside the sort of on the other side of the windows was a window cleaner.
Yeah.
And he used to be there every single day,
mm-hmm.
and he was washing the windows and using his little squeegee. He was probably hanging by ropes, Paul, in your mind, because there was no scaffolding. We were high up. We were on the second floor. But he was out there, this guy, and when I say out there, he was out there from what you, how you described him, he was out there both, because you've described him as being off his face. Stoned, and that had me intrigued. But I mean, where did you come up with that, Paul?
Well, you mentioned a window cleaner at one point out the window, and you never mentioned the window cleaner again. And then we were trying to work. Okay, so one of the things that comes really strongly through Loose Units is the fact that I thought, and I think many people think, that when you're a cop, you have a kind of partner who is with you the whole time, right? And your partner was, not his real name, Julian. And Julian's a big through line. And I was sitting there with this window cleaner. And because I'm basing these stories on real things, I've got a window cleaner who's outside who you suspected may have been like smoking weed. I think it was like a throwaway comment when we were at this bar. You may have just been like talking nonsense, or you may have remembered some detail. Mm. And I just thought, shit, what if I made that Julian? And what if when the police instructor is running through the different types of, you know, specialities that cops can end up in, he finishes on undercover, and then he's on cue, the undercover guy outside the window comes in, like rappels in the window like an action hero, and reveals that the whole thing was a stunt to basically, you know, pretty much just blow away the students with the efficacy of good undercover work because the window cleaner had been there all week.
It's a great story, Paul, but it's unfortunately it bears no. It's just you have got a very, very fertile imagination on this particular issue, and that actually never happened.
But did you like it when you read it?
I loved it.
That's all that matters. Yeah.
It was brilliant, and it is brilliant, and it's very plausible, but it didn't happen on this particular occasion. Because that character, who is real, he comes to fruition later.
Yes, he does. But, yeah, it was just... there are certain gaps in your knowledge...
that you had to fill.
That I have to fill. There's certain cases where you would sit there and go, I remember nothing except the outcome.
Yeah.
And I would literally give you like a sketch of a, you know, semi-fictional or like very fictional version of events, like a fight or a chase or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you would say, look, as long as we end up in that place, that's cool. So there's a thing in pro wrestling, Dad, where basically every single beat of a fight and, you know, all the speeches and the yelling and the choreography, it's all choreographed, it's all planned. But if something goes wrong or if they go off script or whatever, let's say a table doesn't break over someone's back, then they have to basically just make shit up for the next 20 minutes. And as long as they end up at that key point, and that weirdly enough, that wrestling adage is what I applied here. But Neil Gaiman, who's a wonderful author, I interviewed him about 8 years ago, and he said this thing that I really loved once. And he said that something doesn't need to have happened to be true. So if you ground a thing in the truth of a character, you can kind of take things off in weird directions. Julian is a fascinating character who we're going to talk about a lot this season, and readers of Loose Units will know a lot about Julian. They won't know a lot of the really interesting behind-the-scenes stuff, which we're going to get into a little bit of throughout this season. But suffice to say, we have now taken you up to the end of purely... No, what chapter are we up to? Oh, okay, hang on, let's see. Let's have a look. Let me just open a copy of Loose Units and see what chapter we're up to. Okay, so we've done the prologue and Don't Be a Tool. So really, Dad, that means that next week we're going to be doing Purely Academical, which covers your time at the academy. It covers that really great story about that inspection of the apartment. And then we might take a look at Oh Captain, My Captain, which is the next chapter after that, which involves a pretty interesting story with you during training, sort of becoming it like a, you know, like a placeholder goodwill ambassador in the class. What does it feel like to be revisiting before we wrap things up? How did that feel for you?
I'm enjoying it, and I like the fact that this is almost slightly like an interview, where you tease things out of me, and I think it's great, and I love reading the book again. So yeah, it's wonderful, and I like to really focus on each chapter and really get into it because it's really, really interesting. Comparing, you know, the actual story to what you've written and the stuff that it brings, and obviously you can't fit everything into the book. It'd be volumes. So yeah. But yeah, I mean, that just brings me back to that time when you once approached me and said, "Dad, I'd like to blah blah blah," and I simply said, "Mate, sorry, not enough info." And then you've done two books and the podcast.
Four seasons. We've done four seasons of the podcast.
Shows. It's pretty good. And I'm sure there's a lot more buried deep within my mind.
Well, with that in mind, everyone, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Loose Units Origins. It's the beginning of a brand new season, and we've got, you can tell at the rate at which we're going through, there's like 40 chapters in the book, and we've done the prologue and the first chapter. This is going to be a very, very big, deep season, and as it goes on, we will start delving really deep into some of the behind-the-scenes stuff and through some of the, you know, the truth behind the cases, but also Dad's memory is going to start getting jogged, and we're going to find out more stuff that we never knew even happened. So please let us know what you thought of the episode over at facebook.com/loose units. We can't wait to hear from you, and we will see you this Friday for an episode of Loose Ends. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.